Okay, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome Dan Renshaw into the studio. Welcome, Dan.
Well, thank you, Mike.
We've now done, I believe, 6 of these interviews, and we're on to number 7.
Boy, I've lost count. I thought it was more than that.
Well, maybe we did one more that sort of blended. But the topic today we do have pretty clearly. We've been talking about mining. We've been talking about life throughout a number of different periods of time when there were not so many people here. But my understanding is today our focus is going to be on what happens to all that stuff that comes out of the ground.
Oh, yeah. You can see the waste dumps where the rock that was removed necessary to get to the vein is all exposed and obvious that it's truly a waste dump. But that's just the part of it. Everything that was productive underground all had to be brought to the surface, usually in difficult terms. There's some of the mines that were incredibly complex. For example, Independence was what's called a winze development. 900 level of the Independence went in on a horizontal.
Okay.
Just enough grade so an ore car would come out by gravity, and just enough grade so drainage would come out to the surface. But inside the mountain, terribly complex operation, went down the vein. The dip of the vein on the 900 of the Independence was a variable, but around 20 degrees. So here you have this work progressing down the vein, and then at roughly 100-foot intervals down the vein, they would put what they call drifts out on either side that would be in the vein proper, but again on the horizontal.
So you use the term drift, and I'm thinking snow drifts. I'm thinking all kinds of other things. What is a drift?
Oh, man, we should bring in a list of mining terms here and go over them. But a drift is an opening underground, call it a tunnel if you wish, which is a misnomer. But let's call it a tunnel. And it's in the vein material, but on a horizontal. So you're drifting in the vein is the concept.
Okay.
Now, when you travel down the vein, perpendicular to a drift, it's called a winze, W-I-N-Z-E.
W-I-N-Z-E.
Z-E, yeah, with the Z on the end. Contrary to that, if you went from a drift up, now that's called a wind, a raise. Now, when a raise hits a winze, why, who knows? But where I'm going is that in the Independence now, they from a drift level, they had ore chutes. Now, there's several ways to spell that. C-H-U-T-E was a device used for accumulating the material that's up above it,
right,
brought down to it for loading it into an ore car. And then the ore chute itself is another name, and boy, I'm getting confused on the spelling on the two of them. But anyway, the idea is that big room was made in the vein of productive material to be extracted, and gravity helping to be brought down to a drift level where it could be loaded into a car. From there, it was hauled over to a transfer station where it was dumped into a skip, which brought it up rails from in the winze. So at an upper level, above the 900, there was a winding device, a cable, for hauling the skip up. And the skip then dumped into another ore car that's on the horizontal that would take it out to the surface. And then it was dumped into a surge bin. And then it was dumped into a aerial tram ore car and taken down to the mill. So, you know, this is arduous, complicated.
Oh, wow. The thought of it.
A lot of labor went into all of the handling of the ore. We'd mentioned the magic number. If you were milling pick a number, 100 tons, you had 100 men somewhere on the property.
Right.
20 tons, you got 20 men at least.
Okay.
Because it's so labor intensive getting all of this ore handled, broken, handled again, rehandled, and finally get it to the surface.
So when you say broken, that may be another image that I need a little help with. How much was it broken into what would be considered a normal size piece?
Yeah, the run of mine ore. You would the thing you're after is to break it sufficiently that a man can load it with a shovel.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Good image. You got that.
Yeah. Now, in some places, bigger pieces, of course, were picked up and put on top of the load. Maybe a sledgehammer was used to reduce some of the larger pieces. But for the most part, it's small enough that the average piece reporting to the coarse ore bin at the mill would probably be, I'll pick a number, 4 inches.
Okay.
Okay. Right. A lot of fines, and a few big pieces. Usually dumped onto what was called a grizzly. So anything larger than 4 inches, the person receiving the ore at the coarse ore bin, the run-of-mine bin, he would have to reduce that with a sledgehammer to get it to go through the grizzly.
Okay.
And then it's in the mill circuit. So the next step from the mill circuit is you need to reduce the run of mine down to, through a crushing stage, down to about 3/4 inch minus, something small enough that you can handle it more easily. Mainly what you're after is to be able to get a continuous mill feed to whatever mill device you have. So you have to have it fairly fine in order to be able to get that conveyance down to a steady state. In milling, generally, whatever the device is that you're using for reducing the ore down to a liberation point, we've talked about that before.
Right.
We're needing to get crushing and grinding sufficiently down that we're going to be able to get the individual particles of gold free. Once they're free, then we got a chance to do some recovery, usually with mercury.
Okay.
So in the early days, we need to, again, let me review, we need to divide the Willow Creek Mining District into two pieces. Generally, before the railroad came in with their road improvement program, pick a number, 1930, roughly. Before that, everything was difficult as far as transportation goes. The roads were in very poor condition. All of the equipment that had to be brought in was brought in on the most arduous way. When the railroad finally did the resource road work and improved the roads using the Federal Alaska Road Commission, suddenly the roads were good enough that it wasn't the big problem on getting more equipment in. Mm-hmm. And we had talked previously about this being a landmark thing where this also allowed the use of diesel engines because now you could bring in fuel where you couldn't before. It was difficult to get fuel in. So in the early days before the road improvement, the paramount issue having to do with ore was, and the word that was used is wooded plate. Plate meaning that the recovery method after the crushing and the grinding was a large sheet of copper that had been electrolytically coated on the top side with silver.
Right.
So that mercury would adhere to it, and a thin film of mercury would be put on this plate. Everything coming out of the milling device would pass over that plate, and the gold then would have a chance to connect with the mercury and stick. And that was the method of recovery. There was a necessity to save those tailings because in the early days, they weren't getting all of the gold by any chance. Trying to remember the number, it was a substantial number, like at the bullion mine. We talked about the mill there.
Right.
The ore, some of it in excess of 2 ounces per ton, though the tailing pond, in some cases, there were parts of it that were in excess of 3/4 of an ounce per ton that they didn't get by plating. Several reasons for that at the bullion mine. So the big issue early on is they wanted to find a mill, anything they could mill. Carl, for example, we talked about Carl, who was the first one to do a decent job at getting even a wagon road in.
Mm-hmm.
He had a small mill in the upper Fishhook Valley, and everybody wanted to use it so they could plate their ore to see if it was going to be recoverable, a big issue.
So just winding back a little bit to the ore is in the ground, deep in the ground. The variety of seams of gold will vary in terms of how much you have to take out of that deep mine in order to... I'm getting my own mind around the issue of this is not a situation where there's a wide seam of gold pure there. I just chop it out and bring it up. If not all cases, it's mixed in with a large amount of rock that I have to bring in.
The waste rock, you can imagine in a case where you've got a winds development where your drifting is underneath, most of the work is done in the vein.
Okay.
But you still have a lot of waste rock because the vein is an old fault that has been replaced by quartz material. Usually the better veins were replaced multiple times, that there was post-movement on the fault after the first emplacement of quartz. And some of the richer veins, they could see in microsections using a microscope that the multiple layers that brought in not only the quartz but the gold made for richer and richer ore. So you'd usually be able to know that you're on a vein that had post-movement because on one or other or both of the walls of the vein, you'd be smooth.
Okay.
Where you had some post-movement that hadn't been replaced by quartz. But the idea being that these old fault zones with current movement on them can be very, very thin, 6 inches of ground-up material, and then in a short distance become very considerable in thickness, 10 feet or more.
Uh-huh.
Now, the values are usually in the areas that are thicker. But in some cases, there was extraordinary value when it got very narrow, but you couldn't mine it. So what you had to do was take some waste rock
around
around it, right, in order to get to it.
So as you were talking about this, I was in my own mind thinking of time lapse photography, only not day to day, but maybe year to year, or even century to century. If we were able to recreate the way in which that gold was laid down in the rock that way,
right.
This was done. This would have to be a time lapse over a huge amount of time.
We don't know. That's an interesting. There used to be two camps in geology. One was the theory that everything was a long stretch of time in order to get all these accomplishment of the various geologic features. But on the other hand, there was a very substantial number of geologists who were catastrophist. And their theory was quite the contrary, that all of these major things took place in a very short period of time rather than over a long period. There's no way to know, Doc. I've got books and books on the subject, and they're very interesting to read on everybody's theory on how these things took place. But whatever the period of time was, the better veins, consistently, it was shown that they had post-movement. Now, if you emplace the quartz one day, can it cool quickly enough that you could have post-movement the second day and then do it? You know, who knows? Yeah. So I tend to be more of a catastrophist in my own observation of a lot of the surface geology that I see. Fascinating up at Hatcher's Pass to look at some of the features that tell me that, my, there's been some dramatic things happen here in rainfall. There looks like there's been places where there's been storms of probably feet of water per hour in order to do the damage that was done.
So the Willow Creek area and Hatcher Pass mines up there, they're at a kind of a lofty elevation. They're up there. And yet, I know that there are some mines in the world that are deep into the ground. And when we think about the covering of the earth, the mantle, is gold in one sense, you know, my image is still that of the molten core and then this whatever floating on top of.
Right.
For some distance. Where is gold distributed vertically from surface into the earth? Is there any sense of where gold is more distributed than other places?
Boy.
I'm trying to do a cross section here and say,
there are areas within which you find more gold deposits than others. There are places in the world where there just isn't any.
Right.
Why the distribution is as it is, I have no idea. The whole idea of how do you create these heavy metals? They come out of, the current theory is they come out of star formation. Stars, we're talking about really ancient past now.
Sure.
Stars that go full cycle and then at the end of their life start creating these heavy metals and so on. So how does that get translated into a planet and the distribution there is such a complex thing going on that it is an awfully difficult thing to describe. But let me give you just a kind of an interesting little example of some variety here. In South Africa, the area called the Witwatersrand near Johannesburg, where it was discovered, when you look at it, it's been my good fortune to go on a mining tour of South Africa back in the 80s, fabulous thing. But when you look at the Witwatersrand, the rand itself, the formation, as it's exposed, both underground and on the surface, you look at it and you shake your head because it's sedimentary.
Oh.
What you had was an ancient basin that was being filled with sediments, and at that time there was an erosion going on in whatever primary source there was for gold.
Okay.
And it came in and enriched some of these, what are called reefs in the rand section, and created hot spots that were quite, very, very high grade for the area, high grade being defined as a tenth of an ounce up to a half an ounce type thing.
Okay.
But when you look at it very closely, here are these pebbles, and you can see behind the pebbles there will be some flecks of gold like it would be distributed in a creek. And then that source is ancient as far as being way back there was an erosion going on somewhere filling a basin creating sedimentary rocks that much, much later were lithified into solid rock And then when man came by and did his, he sunk vertical shafts, some of them in excess of 10,000 feet, in order to access these things and be able to mine them. That's the mining in South Africa, the gold mining that's been, you know, going on for a long time.
Right. I had some idea about that, particularly the sense of the depth. And 10,000 feet, that's just 2 miles, sort of.
And that's and it's a rapid trip to come up out of that or to go down. I've only been as deep as 8,300 feet in one of the gold mines there because of the heat. They had special trained forces to go lower than that were trained to stand the heat. And it was at 8,300. It was just exhausting.
So what causes that kind of heat?
A natural gradient of the earth.
Oh.
Yeah, the deeper you go, the hotter it is. Yeah. And an odd thing, in those mines in the Witwatersrand, the deeper you go, the more methane they have, which becomes a real problem.
Sure.
But there's a combination of things. In those deep depths, they have to lace the wall very tightly with all kinds of cables and steel matting and so on, because they get what are called rock bursts. You know, pressure above you is so extreme that when you make an opening, a drift, a tunnel, that you never know at any given moment, suddenly there'll be a failure of a loose rock that'll be shot out of the side and can do a lot of damage. So there's all of this work that has to go on to anticipate that kind of thing.
So what is the deepest mine in terms of top to bottom depth here in this area?
Oh, in this area.
Let's start with this area.
Yeah. Hatch Pass, none of them got very deep. the Independence from outcrop downwinds to the lower workings, so 1,500 feet, something like that. Similar over at the Lucky Shot. There's a famous mine down in the Grass Valley area of Northern California that is always used by geologists as a comparison of what should be expected in Alaska, because there's so much similarity. Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, it went down to like 3,000 feet on a winds level development. And in our case, I think probably there's a lot of veracity in making that example. But I've been to the Grass Valley Mine, and the thing that that's different down there, they didn't have the glaciation. You know, a lot of the deposit has been lost in the local area. So if it hadn't been that way, would there have been 3,000 feet of depth of ore? Possibly, yes.
Mm-hmm. So what about temperature on the 1,500 feet here in Alaska, if you're going down the mine? What temperature changes would you expect?
It doesn't vary.
That's not
maybe a degree. Generally speaking, mines with portals around 4,000 feet, you're talking about 38 degrees underground year-round.
Okay.
And it's amazingly stable. But there are areas that are, like in the Independence Mine, the 900 level, the main level, ran into an area where the temperatures were below freezing, related to a glacier on top of it.
Okay.
So it's a strange oddity as to why the rocks would be so cold.
So we have temperature, and also I'm wondering about the quality of air in a deep shaft of that sort.
Usually twice a year there's a problem with air circulation naturally, because the 38 degrees underground and your ambient temperatures outground or either above ground are either higher or lower.
Okay.
In fall and spring, when you pass an area where 38 is an average for a while, you can get very still air. But for the most part, mines want to breathe. And it doesn't take but a very few degrees difference for them to breathe in or out.
Okay.
Independence, for example, another good example is the 2000 level was driven in, called a water tunnel level, underneath all of the vein mining up above on the main vein. And it was used then as a haulage level with raises up to the actual ore chutes where the ore was passed down. In the winter months, that particular tunnel is exhaling. Air enters up above. It's
okay.
Excuse me, I've got that backwards. In the winter months, it's inhaling because air entering is colder, ambient, and heated to 38, rises up through the workings and exits the mountainside up above.
Okay.
And this is quite a draft. There is in the water tunnel a draft door that was kept closed at all times, because what happens is the cold air, there's a lot of drainage coming out. All of the tunnel system is drained through the 2000 level. And you can imagine a draft going over that water coming out. You can fill that tunnel with ice in a short order by getting veneer after veneer of frozen material as that draft comes in.
Right.
So you got to cut the draft down as much as you can. In the summer months, then that'll reverse, and you'll have it exhaling, where you're bringing ambient warm air in, cooling it, and it's dropping, and it's coming out down
the other way.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Dan Renshaw, once again, we have managed to fill nearly a half hour.
And never got to the topic.
we were pointed in the right direction.
We were going to try to do some milling, but next time.
Well, we started the milling thing, and that leaves us time in the next edition, our next interview, to do that. Mike Malevsky here with Dan Renshaw, continuing a long series about mining in the Willow Creek mining area.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Dan.